On November 6th, a dull, overcast day developed into a howling blizzard from the southwest, with snow and low drift. Only those who were compelled left the shelter of their tent. Deep drifts formed everywhere, burying sledges and provisions to a depth of 2 feet, and the snow piling up round the tents threatened to burst the thin fabric. The fine drift found its way in through the ventilator of the tent, which was accordingly plugged up with a spare sock. This lasted for 2 days, when one man wrote, "The blizzard continued through the morning, but cleared towards noon, and it was a beautiful evening. But we would far rather have the screeching blizzard with its searching drift and cold, damp wind, for we drifted about 11 miles to the north during the night." For 4 days the fine weather continued, with gloriously warm, bright sun, but cold when standing still or in the shade. The temperature usually dropped below zero, but every opportunity was taken during these fine, sunny days to partially dry our sleeping bags and other gear, which had become sodden through our body heat having thawed the snow which had drifted in onto them during the blizzard. The bright sun seemed to put new heart into all. The next day brought a northeasterly wind with the very high temperature of 27 degrees Fahrenheit, only 5 degrees below freezing. These high temperatures do not always represent the warmth which might be assumed from the thermometrical readings. They usually bring dull, overcast skies with a raw, muggy, moisture-laden wind. The winds from the south, though colder, are nearly always coincident with sunny days and clear blue skies. The temperature still continued to rise, reaching 33 degrees Fahrenheit on November 14th. The thaw consequent upon these high temperatures was having a disastrous effect upon the surface of our camp. The surface is awful, not slushy but elusive. You step out gingerly. All is well for a few paces, then your foot suddenly sinks a couple of feet until it comes to a hard layer. You wade along in this way, step by step, like a mudlark at Portsmouth Hard, hoping gradually to regain the surface. Soon you do, only to repeat the exasperating performance ad lib to the accompaniment of all the expletives that you can bring to bear on the subject. What actually happens is that the warm air melts the surface sufficiently to cause drops of water to trickle down slightly, where, on meeting colder layers of snow, they freeze again, forming a honeycomb of icy nodules instead of the soft, powdery, granular snow that we are accustomed to. These high temperatures persisted for some days, and when, as occasionally happened, the sky was clear and the sun was shining, it was unbearably hot. 5 men who were sent to fetch some gear from the vicinity of the ship with a sledge marched in nothing but trousers and singlet, and even then were very hot. In fact, they were afraid of getting sunstroke, so let down flaps from their caps to cover their necks. Their sleeves were rolled up over their elbows, and their arms were red and sunburnt in consequence. The temperature on this occasion was 26 degrees Fahrenheit, or 6 degrees below freezing. For 5 or 6 days more the sun continued, and most of our clothes and sleeping bags were now comparatively dry. A wretched day with rainy sleet set in on November 21st, but one could put up with this discomfort as the wind was now from the south. The wind veered later to the west, and the sun came out at 9 p.m., for at this time, near the end of November, we had the midnight sun. A thrice-blessed southerly wind soon arrived to cheer us all, occasioning the following remarks in one of the diaries. "Today is the most beautiful day we have had in the Antarctic. A clear sky, a gentle warm breeze from the south, and the most brilliant sunshine." We all took advantage of it to strike tents, clean out and generally dry and air ground sheets and sleeping bags. I was up early, 4 a.m., to keep watch, and the sight was indeed magnificent. Spread out before one was an extensive panorama of ice fields, intersected here and there by small broken leads, and dotted with numerous noble bergs, partly bathed in sunshine and partly tinged with the grey shadows of an overcast sky. As one watched, one observed a distinct line of demarcation between the sunshine and the shade, and this line gradually approached nearer and nearer, lighting up the hummocky relief of the ice field bit by bit, until at last it reached us, and threw the whole camp into a blaze of glorious sunshine which lasted nearly all day. This afternoon we were treated to 1 or 2 showers of hail-like snow. Yesterday we also had a rare form of snow, or rather, precipitation of ice spicules, exactly like little hairs, about 1/3 of an inch long. The warmth in the tents at lunchtime was so great that we had all the side flaps up for ventilation. But it is a treat to get warm occasionally, and one can put up with a little stuffy atmosphere now and again for the sake of it. The wind has gone to the best quarter this evening, the southeast, and is freshening. On these fine, clear, sunny days, wonderful mirage effects could be observed, just as occur over the desert. Huge bergs were apparently resting on nothing, with a distinct gap between their bases and the horizon. Others were curiously distorted into all sorts of weird and fantastic shapes, appearing to be many times their proper height. Added to this, the pure, glistening white of the snow and ice made a picture which it is impossible adequately to describe. Later on, the freshening southwesterly wind brought mild, overcast weather, probably due to the opening up of the pack in that direction. I had already made arrangements for a quick move in case of a sudden breakup of the ice. Emergency orders were issued. Each man had his post allotted and his duty detailed. And the whole was so organized that in less than 5 minutes from the sounding of the alarm on my whistle, tents were struck, gear and provisions packed, and the whole party was ready to move off. I now took a final survey of the men to note their condition, both mental and physical. For our time at Ocean Camp had not been one of unalloyed bliss. The loss of the ship meant more to us than we could ever put into words. After we had settled at Ocean Camp, she still remained nipped by the ice, only her stern showing and her bows overridden and buried by the relentless pack. The tangled mass of ropes, rigging and spars made the scene even more desolate and depressing. It was with a feeling almost of relief that the end came. November 21st, 1915. This evening, as we were lying in our tents, we heard the boss call out, "She's going, boys!" We were out in a second, and up on the lookout station and other points of vantage, and, sure enough, there was our poor ship, a mile and a half away, struggling in her death agony. She went down bows first, her stern raised in the air. She then gave one quick dive, and the ice closed over her forever. It gave one a sickening sensation to see it, for, mastless and useless as she was, she seemed to be a link with the outer world. Without her, our destitution seems more emphasized, our desolation more complete. The loss of the ship sent a slight wave of depression over the camp. No one said much, but we cannot be blamed for feeling it in a sentimental way. It seemed as if the moment of severance from many cherished associations, many happy moments, even stirring incidents, had come as she silently upended to find a last resting place beneath the ice on which we now stand. When one knows every little nook and corner of one's ship, as we did, and has helped her time and again in the fight that she made so well, the actual parting was not without its pathos, quite apart from one's own desolation. And I doubt if there was one amongst us who did not feel some personal emotion when Sir Ernest, riding on the top of the lookout, said somewhat sadly and quietly, "She's gone, boys." It must, however, be said that we did not give way to depression for long, for soon everyone was as cheery as usual. Laughter rang out from the tents, and even the boss had a passage at arms with the storekeeper over the inadequacy of the sausage ration, insisting that there should be two each, because they were such little ones, instead of the one and a half that the latter proposed. The psychological effect of a slight increase in the ration soon neutralized any tendency to downheartedness, but with the high temperatures, surface thaw set in, and our bags and clothes were soaked and sodden. Our boots squelched as we walked, and we lived in a state of perpetual wet feet. At nights, before the temperature had fallen, clouds of steam could be seen rising from our soaking bags and boots. During the night, as it grew colder, this all condensed as rime on the inside of the tent and showered down upon us if one happened to touch the side inadvertently. One had to be careful how one walked, too, as often only a thin crust of ice and snow covered a hole in the floe through which many an unwary member went in up to his waist. These perpetual soakings, however, seemed to have had little lasting effect, or perhaps it was not apparent owing to the excitement of the prospect of an early release. A northwesterly wind on December 7th and 8th retarded our progress somewhat, but I had reason to believe that it would help to open the ice and form leads through which we might escape to open water. So I ordered a practice launching of the boats and stowage of food and stores in them. This was very satisfactory. We cut a slipway from our floe into a lead which ran alongside, and the boats took the water like a bird, as one sailor remarked. Our hopes were high in anticipation of an early release. A blizzard sprang up, increasing the next day and burying tents and packing cases in the drift. On December 12th it had moderated somewhat and veered to the southeast, and the next day the blizzard had ceased, but a good steady wind from the south and southwest continued to blow us north. December 15th, 1915. The continuance of southerly winds is exceeding our best hopes and raising our spirits in proportion. Prospects could not be brighter than they are just now. The environs of our flow are continually changing. Some days we are almost surrounded by small open leads, preventing us from crossing over to the adjacent flows. After 2 more days, our fortune changed, and a strong northeasterly wind brought a beastly cold, windy day, and drove us back 3.25 miles. Soon, however, the wind once more veered to the south and southwest. These high temperatures, combined with the strong changeable winds that we had had of late, led me to conclude that the ice all around us was rotting and breaking up, and that the moment of our deliverance from the icy maw of the Antarctic was at hand. On December 20th, after discussing the question with Wilde, I informed all hands that I intended to try and make a march to the west to reduce the distance between us and Paulet Island. A buzz of pleasurable anticipation went round the camp, and everyone was anxious to get on the move. So the next day I set off with Wilde, Crean, and Hurley, with dog teams, to the westward to survey the route. After travelling about 7 miles, we mounted a small berg, and there, as far as we could see, stretched a series of immense flat floes from 0.5 mile to 1 mile across, separated from each other by pressure ridges which seemed easily negotiable with pick and shovel. The only place that appeared likely to be formidable was a very much cracked-up area between the old floe that we were on and the first of the series of young flat floes about 0.5 mile away. December 22nd was therefore kept as Christmas Day, and most of our small remaining stock of luxuries was consumed at the Christmas feast. We could not carry it all with us, so for the last time for 8 months we had a really good meal, as much as we could eat. Anchovies in oil, baked beans, and jugged hare made a glorious mixture such as we have not dreamed of since our school days. Everybody was working at high pressure, packing and repacking sledges, and stowing what provisions we were going to take with us in the various sacks and boxes. As I looked round at the eager faces of the men, I could not but hope that this time the fates would be kinder to us than in our last attempt to march across the ice to safety.